I'm Becca Lewis, and I'm your host for the Shift the Story podcast, where we share ideas and inspiration for living life differently. This podcast is the second in the series, What Reality Do You Live In Really? As I listened to the podcast to prepare it for its re-release, I was caught up again in the simplicity of consciously choosing the reality we want to live in. Of course, it means we have to know ourselves well enough to make that shift, but we always have the right and the means to do so. The why of its importance is sometimes so obvious we forget. And that's what I think this series does, reminds us of the reasons and the outcome. Once again, Del and I cover a multitude of subjects, including the subjects of hypnotism, struggle, states of perception, and what happens when we shift. What changes? It's a subtle but important answer. Come with us as we shift the story together. This is the second in the series, What Reality Do You Live In? What Difference Does It Make? And Do You Know What It Is Anyway?
Number two, yes.
Number two. Okay. So just, do you want to do a short review of what we did in the...
Let's review what we did.
Okay.
A little bit.
You do it.
Okay. Remember, we were talking about the game.
Yes.
The big game.
Yes.
Remember, and right there toward the end, we were talking about Madison, the little girl, the 11-year-old.
Yes.
Let's review that just a little bit.
Okay.
Because you really had a lot of insight on that. That was really, really well the way you put that. So would you rehash that again? Talk about that again?
Well, what I talked about was whoever has the most wisdom has the most responsibility.
Yes.
And most of us think, get into that mode where, well, it's the other person's fault. And which goes back to the original thing that you can't blame the other players in the game. But if you're the most aware in the game, and you have the most awareness how to get out of the game, you're responsible for it. And you set everybody else free in that concept. So what I had said to her was, even though she was 11, she had the most awareness of what was true of anybody that she was dealing with. And so she had the responsibility of staying in that reality and not wish that other people would get there.
Yeah, so that was the same thing as we're talking about. It's directly the same thing as what we're talking about, the Iroquois is... As far as if you had the most.
Yes.
Well, it's the same thing. When you have the most wisdom, well, where are people going to get it from? If they're not listening within themselves,
right?
They would go to you or you would provide that for them. And the sense, the reason why that is more reflective of what is truth, unlike the material things where it starts to dissolve or disappear and get used up and become less and less, in the idea of trueness and of wisdom and that perfection of being, it never runs out. And the more you use it, the more you are that.
Yes.
And the more it stays put.
Yes.
That's why it's a very good example of that.
Yes. All you have to do is actually do it.
All you have to do is do it.
Yes.
Instead of going to, like you said, well, why can't they get this? And, you know,
yes,
Start blaming them for being whatever, and that's defeating the whole idea.
Yeah, because then you're thinking that that the game is real, and that actually is what we're talking about, is although we may appear to be living in a game, and however you look at it, we're thinking that the game has reality to it, and the people in the game have a reality, when really the game is subjective to who we are.
Mm, right. Yes.
So in a sense, I'm telling her, take the wise part of you and take the rest of you with it.
Yes. And as she uses that wisdom and gets more involved with using it, with the idea of truth, keeping that there intact, she gains more wisdom. It gets more understood within herself.
Right.
And she becomes more and more of that.
Right.
Yes.
Well, one of the things we were talking about, and we're going to talk about today a lot, is how do you know what reality you're in, which is a good question, and how do you get out of it? So those are the things that we're focusing on today. But one of the things that we had just talked about today was asking that question we talked about. You need to ask the question, is this true?
Yeah.
And there's a number of ways to look at that question. Is it true within the game? That's a good way to look at the question and the results of that, which I know you want to talk about. And is it true? Is it true? Is it true as a part of Big R Reality? But true in the game.
True, yeah. If we ask, well, and when we look at the word true, if we're using a capital T, like the absolute truth, well, that's when you're in a limited, finite sense of something called the human sense of the world or the game, and you ask, well, is that true? You're basing it on the context of the game. And anything that is absolute and infinite, from that point of view, would be not true. It would be like, oh, that's not true. That doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Of course, it's not that way. It's this way. It's limited. You have to work for it. You have to struggle. That's what's true. Where asking that question from absolute, from mm-hmm. that firm viewpoint of perfection, mm-hmm. then you know. It's very easy to know if
yes.
something's true or not.
Well, that kind of goes to that idea that we talk about all the time, that the only way to know what's not true is to know what is.
Yes, absolutely.
Which is not what we're trained. We're trained to look at what's not true, what's not true, what's not true, what's not true. And somewhere in there, we'll figure out what's true, and that will never, ever, ever, ever happen.
Yes.
You can't figure it out from what's not true.
Yes.
It's in spite of the many attempts to do so.
Right.
So the only way you can figure it out is by beginning with truth, or your highest awareness of what truth is. And then what's not true just stands out with great relief.
Mm-hmm.
Not both ways. Both ways, I mean relief. So you're talking about an objective awareness. Ask the question, is that true? Detaching from the game and asking.
Yes. It's a necessity. You have to detach from the game. So detachment is a good word. Detach from anything material. Otherwise, if you're still attached to the material, you're coming from that viewpoint that it's material, and then you're asking a question based on the game.
And more, what you were talking about is that physicists and physics know that it's not material.
Yes, they know it's a thought universe.
Not like it used to be, like with Darwin and competition.
Yeah.
And
Darwin and Newton, mechanical universe, and they figured they had everything figured out. And then the quantum came along and they go, whoa, we don't.
Yeah.
Not even close.
So they're getting to that sense. Well, they are at that sense. It's just some ways they don't want to, like, take the... It's the same thing I always used to think of when people would say perception is reality, and then I'd think, well, we'll take it to the end then. If perception is reality, then shift your perception to reality. I don't understand why we would just say something and not do anything about it. But it's the same thing with the scientist who says that reality is subjective but won't take it to the end of what that means. But we are. The people on the call, the people who are looking at what true reality is taking it to what that means and not being stuck in, well, I can only take it as far as the game says I can.
Right.
So... which was, we wanted to read a couple stories today.
Yes.
And so I'm going to read the first one, and I'll tell you where it's from. It's from a talk given by a woman named Jane Smith to a church in Long Beach in 1974. And the reason I have a copy of this is because my wonderful mentor, Dorothy, used to supply me with all these wonderful old talks, and this is one of my favorites. So we're going to take three stories from it. And... it's a true story, and she's talking about a friend of hers who had a friend who was an expert hypnotist in San Francisco, and the friend used to talk to his friend, the hypnotist, time to time, and the hypnotist said to the scientist, so it was a scientist who didn't really believe the possibility of us being hypnotized without the physical, you know, I'm going to hypnotize
you. Right. Yeah, the old, here's the watch,
yeah.
Here's the spiral thing,
right.
Look at this, and you're going, getting sleepy, yeah.
It doesn't work that way
right.
anymore, or it never did, but so what we're talking about when we're talking about the game is that we're living in the illusion of a hypnotic state, really. So this is a story about how this person learned about it. So the scientist, he told a scientist friend, one of these days I'm going to hypnotize you, and then you're going to understand what we're talking about. Well, the scientists used to rather good-naturedly scoff at this. So one night they went to a dinner
in the Persian room of the St. Francis Hotel in San Francisco, and the scientist ordered lamb chops. Presently, the waitress served him, and he looked down at his plate and he said, just a minute, miss, you've made a mistake in my order. I ordered lamb chops, not watermelon. Well, she said, what watermelon? And he said, this watermelon. And he held up a big slab of watermelon right there in front of him. She said, are you trying to put me on? No, he said, I'm talking about this. I know that I ordered lamb chops. She said, well, I served you lamb chops, and that's what you've got. And they got into quite an argument. So, just as an aside here, two people trying to agree on a subjective reality.
Yes.
Finally, he caught a glimpse of his friend's face across from him, which had a smirk on it. And he stopped, and he looked right at him, and he said, you finally did it, didn't you? And that broke the spell. And he looked back at his plate, and where an instant before had been a big slab of watermelon were the lamb chops. He rather shamefully excused himself to the girl, and the two went on with their meal. It was that simple.
Yeah.
And it's that simple, and we'll talk more about the ways that we actually allow ourselves to be drawn into an illusion.
Often. No, just about, well, daily.
Yeah.
Daily.
So the beginning of it, though, is to recognize that it's a possibility. That's what happens.
Yes.
And then Don Juan talked about how to get out of that with his wonderful quote about...
The breaking point?
The somersault.
Oh, the somersault quote, yes. Let me find that quote. It's here somewhere. He said, a crucial point of reference is freedom of perception. It is intent. It is the spirit, the somersault of thought into the miraculous, the act of reaching beyond our boundaries and touching the inconceivable.
Well, I love that, touching the inconceivable.
Yes.
So somersaulting into the inconceivable, basically.
Yes, and you know, I think from my viewpoint, the reason he's using the idea of the somersault is it's complete turning over of everything we think it is.
Yeah.
Because as long as we're still thinking of it from the context of the world that we think is real,
mm-hmm.
It's not going to be inconceivable.
Mm-hmm.
We can't conceive of it.
Yeah.
And so how can it possibly be inconceivable? We can't get out of that rut, out of that shell that we're in, that bubble of perception.
So first we have to agree that we are in a bubble of perception.
Yes.
And that's the first stage.
Yes, and that is like Don Juan had talked about in another place where he's talked about the bubble of perception. It's like after when we're born and we get this description of the world laid on us, and then we look at this bubble outside of ourselves and we see a reflection, and the reflection is what we're thinking. Our thoughts are reflected off the surface of the bubble, and that's what we see.
Right.
Because that's what we're taught to think and see, and then we keep seeing that. And then the more we keep seeing it, thinking it, the more real it becomes.
What you perceive to be reality magnifies.
And it's all perception, based on a very small, finite, lacking kind of thing.
That's limited. The thing that's amazing, is that we've agreed to such a small perception. But one of the things that we wanted to talk about is how do you know that you're not in true reality, and how do you know you're in your smaller reality? And so we talked about a few things, like if you're defending it.
Yeah.
If you're in defense, you're probably in the smaller reality.
Yeah, you might want to step away from that, detach from that defensive standing, and then say, well, wait a minute, is this true?
Yeah.
But if you stay attached to this defensive idea, the mode of that, you're in it, period.
But what's really interesting in that, and I've experienced it with myself many times, because somebody like you will say something, and I go straight to the defense, but I've learned enough to say to myself, is that true? Within the second of feeling myself go to defense, and then it just dissolves. It just goes away. I don't have to go into some weird state to get back.
Exactly.
It just goes away, and it's like, I don't even know what that was. It was kind of like a fleeting thing that went through my being, but had no attachment to me, and I know you've seen that happen. So
many times.
First I go to defense, and it lasts like, 5 seconds at the most, because I ask, is that true? No. And then when I just answer, that's not true, or is it possible I'm wrong? That's a big one. Then it automatically shifts the perception. Because real reality, the big R reality, doesn't need, the other one is that it doesn't need any justification.
None whatsoever.
So I don't have to, if you find yourself justifying your actions, you might be in the small R reality.
Mm-hmm.
Because you've got it.
Yeah.
I did that once, just a couple of weeks ago. There was something really minor that I was thinking of doing, and I kept feeling that I was justifying it, and then it just seemed like, well, yeah, you have a right to do it. And I realized that I was getting ready to justify something that would haunt me for quite a while, which was so small, and that's why I was justifying it, but it would have haunted me anyway. And when it kept me in the small R reality, and as soon as I dropped it, then I felt 1,000 times better.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting. It also reminded me of, and talk about when you defend your reality, you're reminding me when I used to work at what used to be, what was that, Dean Witter?
Dean Witter, yeah. Morgan
and
Stanley Dean Witter.
It wasn't actually Dean Witter, so I have to fix it. It wasn't Dean Witter. It was a company I worked at before Dean Witter, so it was in the 70s.
Oh, Sigma.
Yes, about the time that I was reading all these stories. And I was trying to work within Big R reality in a financial planning firm and doing well until there was a downturn in the market. And so from up in the higher ups, they freaked out, like, oh, no, things are not going to work anymore. We're in, and they passed it down through the ranks till it got to my boss, who said, well, Becca, I know we had this agreement before that you could do it your way, which, by the way, was working, but you no longer can. We have to go back to the basics. And what they meant by going back to the basements was, back to the basics,
back to the dark place,
to the dark place of hard sell. Don't be nice anymore. Don't be patient anymore. Don't do the right thing anymore. Go back to survival, mm-hmm. which, of course, never worked, and I couldn't stay there. But it's interesting. That's how we go back. That's how you know you're in small R, when you go back to that basics. Go back to the basics is not really a statement we want to live with.
Right.
In that sense. So the next question is, does it make a difference which reality we live in? Because there's more than one. We agree that everybody has their own perception, so that's their own reality.
Yeah, there's
billions.
There's billions, and yet all those billions are based on one game, which is
lack and duality.
And duality, yes.
Lack, so the game is lack and duality, but everybody has their version.
Yeah, there's a lot of different versions, but it's all the same game. And they all have a beginning and an ending.
So it makes a difference?
I would say it makes a difference.
So, you know, different those little realities have different little stories they tell in them. Like, some families have a story that in our family we always have a tragedy every generation, or another family may have a story that there's no tragedies in their family.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe bad things, but no tragedies. And other families may have a story like all the women get some disease.
Sure.
So that's...
Well, like in the Forrest Gump movie, that Lieutenant Dan and his family, every male died in a war throughout his whole lineage.
Yeah.
Because that's just the belief that they
had.
That
was their perception.
That's what they did.
Agreed to.
Yeah.
Since that's all it is. It's
all
an agreement.
It's an agreement.
But it makes it seem like harder, because if your whole family has agreed to a perception, that could be
and
a
that's
big
what
thing.
And that's what you hear maybe around the dining room table.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, remember such and such? He died in World War. Oh, and then blah, blah, died in blah, blah. And, you know, just on and on. So you just hear that programming, and you start saying it without being aware that you're saying it. It's automatic.
I belong to this family, so I say this.
Yes.
And, well, the first step out of that is to not belong to that family. It's to realize that we don't have a heritage, that kind of heritage, or that kind of programming, that to step out of that family and say, I don't have a human family. I am the expression of divine love in the broader sense, in the big R reality.
Right. Yes.
And that seems harder than really it needs to be.
It's harder. It's the continuity of it is the difficult part, which you'll have a story later on that that kind of talks about that continuity that is essential to break that hypnotic trance of worldview things. So
that whatever game we're playing, it has suffering involved in it.
Yes.
Has lack. What we talked about last time, lack breeds. I love the statement. I just can't say it well. Lack breeds greed.
Yes.
That's the story that we've been living in. And but again, it's not blaming the game. I mean, blaming the game, not the people, because the people have been inserted into the game. So everything comes back to the sense of lack, which is the earth part of the game. So we have this belief that we're human, dualistic, and have to have suffering to learn.
Yes.
Which I like that Krishnamurti quote that you talk about.
Yes, Krishnamurti. It's no measure of health to be well-adjusted to a profoundly sick society. That's pretty good.
Excellent idea.
No measure of health to be well-adjusted to a profoundly sick society.
So all the people that say you're crazy, you know, you might want to say thank you. If you're thinking differently, you're marching to a different drum, and people say, boy, you're crazy, you're insane. You go, whoa, thank God. Well, truly, thank God.
Yes, definitely, truly.
So the other one that you talked about, Rolling Thunder and the children.
Well, there were some parents who, a couple that came to Rolling Thunder and said, our children, they're just out of control. We just can't do anything with them. We need a healing to go on for them children because, it's just terrible. We can hardly deal with it. And he said, it's not the children. It's you. He said, the healing has to happen within yourself first.
Which is true.
It is
always
true.
About not just the children.
Because, it's the thought. And you keep saying that, and you keep... Without seeing what the truth of life is, again, you get that thing laid on you, the description of the world right out of the gate, and then you keep saying it, and then after you get older, you things adjust a little bit, get a little bit more distorted, and then you keep saying that, and then you see the outward picture of it in children or whatever, and you go, oh my God, look at this, this is awful. Yeah. And without doing anything within yourself,
you know,
how you're thinking, what the process is, how you're enabling it or supporting it.
Right.
And so it is awareness and perception.
And we enable and support it because we think it has truth and validity to it.
Yes.
So in the small R game, like we might have a child that's giving us a problem and we think, well, they have a right to have it. Mm-hmm. So we've actually taken them out of truth instead of standing in the perfection of who they are, starting with ourselves. Who are we in the perfection? Mm-hmm. But we often take the guilt of living in the small world reality and try to fix it in the wrong way.
Yes. We usually attempt to fix the problem with the same mind that created the problem. And it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
You have to get out of that place completely.
So back to that, you can't tell what's true by staying in what's not true.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go to what's true. The other thing we talked about is that the Constitution has a statement in it called the Pursuit of Happiness.
Yeah, I remember talking about that.
And really, the pursuit, that's an erroneous statement. And it's a perception that we have to find it, get it, win it, strive it, seek after.
Yes, it means you don't have it right now, so
right.
But we're going to let you go for it.
You can go search for it.
You go out there and find it.
Uh-huh.
And again, everything is pointed in that direction. You have to go outside of yourself and find it somewhere. And of course, in our society, it's all about things and stuff.
Yeah.
The more things you have, then of course, all the advertisements, commercials show, oh, you're much happier, see?
Yeah.
Look at the nice car they own, and look at the smile on their face.
So they're pandering to the need to have because
yes,
you think you
part
don't.
Of, part of the game.
Right.
Part of the game.
And the other part of the game that you talked about in this is that right wing, left wing, with that we go to sides. So we're on the right wing, we're on the left wing.
Yes, and we don't think about, well, what is the body? If we look at the body, the embodiment of wisdom and perfection, and then, of course, the wings would be an outward form of that, and they would work perfectly and harmoniously. But when we start to dissect things and distort things, and then we pull the wings off the very body mm-hmm. and start having this wing over here, mm-hmm. which says this is true, and this wing over there, which says, no, that's not true, this is, well, there's no body in between to actually connect the wings.
Right.
And the wings are fighting each other. It is no wonder we don't get anywhere.
Yeah.
Except worse off.
Because we still stay within that survival
game. We stay within
game.
that context of lack, limitation, survival, struggle. Oh, my God.
Well, so the next question is, if you decide you like one reality better than the other, can you switch? And I know that's a trick question. But it's not really, because that's what a lot of people think. They get the idea what you perceive to be reality magnifies, and they say, okay, well, I'll just pick a better reality, and they call it positive thinking. Or I'll just cover this up with that, and it'll be better.
Huh.
So I'll just move over to a new way of thinking, but within the game. So yes, the answer is yes, you can switch it and choose a different reality.
I see.
But most people do it within the game itself.
They do, yeah. It's like the old Terrington cigarette commercial back in the late 60s or something, where I'd rather fight than switch.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah.
And
I don't know why that came
up. I don't know why.
I just saw this black eye and I went, oh my God, that's right. There was a commercial that said, I'd rather fight than switch.
A black eye, I'd rather fight than switch.
And really, in that small R reality, it is a lot like that. No, I don't want to switch. I'd rather fight.
I'd rather
because I'm used to it.
Yes.
It's been going on thousands of years, of course.
Yeah.
I'm reminded of a fellow I used to work for, and he was talking to somebody who had got a decent amount of money, and he had a house, trailer, and a car, and he paid all that stuff off, and my employer had asked him, well, what are you going to do now? He said, hey, I'm not going to do much at all. I'm just going to just take it easy and not do much at all. And my employer talked to me about that later, and he said, you know, to me, that would be boring as all get out.
Yeah.
He loved the struggle.
Loved it.
He was so used to it.
A lot of people love the struggle.
He would brag about the situations he would get into,
mm-hmm.
and then he would get real clever about getting out of them.
Uh-huh.
So he always had a story. Oh, look what I got myself into. So I had to do this and do that, and he loved telling those stories.
And then he got lots of attention from that story.
Yeah. So that is why, yes. A lot of people would rather fight the idea that, oh, there's a better reality than this one. No, I'm used to this when I'm staying here.
Well, yes, so they don't want to go to the big R reality, and they might do a little switch to a better small R reality or a different version of it.
It's like some people ask, well, that would be boring if everything was perfect. Well, how do you know? How could that possibly...
Well, the word perfect means it can't be boring.
Yes, I was going to say, how could that possibly be true? We just have no concept of what that would be, because it would be so amazing.
Yeah.
And we're used to this petty stuff, so it's like, well.
So what we do is we say, well, this story that I have, living in this small town doing blah, 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 I'm going to switch. I'll become a big city person, and I'll not be like my parents, and I'll believe in spaceships coming to Earth. I just made that whole thing up. So that would be a different reality that you choose instead of the one your parents believed.
Yes.
So you could switch to that reality, but it doesn't solve anything.
No.
So it doesn't, it's coming from the outward instead of the inward.
Right. And you'd still be carrying around that description that you had been born with and given right from the get-go. Even though you changed locations and that kind of thing, you'd still have that basic description, the game plan, really.
So we would still be living in the idea that we had to fix things.
Yes.
And we'd still kind of be dead in that reality, mm-hmm. because big R reality is where life is itself.
Yeah. Again, like you're talking about, you're looking at the outward picture and everything is outward. So whatever you see with your physical eyes, that's got to be what's true. And, you know, it's like you were telling about that story about... back long ago, they used to, you know, people would be, they would look at the person, they'd do
somebody
all the body
checks. Yeah, actually, it's because they were drinking alcohol, you know, that really, whatever that alcohol is, that untreated alcohol or something.
Uh-huh.
So it was common practice for people to appear dead. And so that's where the wake came from, because they would wait to see if they woke up from it. So they would put them on the table. Everybody would like hang around for a couple days to see if they would wake up from that appearance of dead. And then if they didn't wake up from it, they'd bury them.
Right.
But then they found out they were burying people that were still alive.
Now, how did they discover that?
Because they'd see, when they dug them up again, they'd see scratches on the lid of the coffin.
Ouch.
I know. And so that's where they, so then they started putting bells, a string in a coffin that they could ring the bell if they woke up, and the bell above the grave would ring, and that's where the phrase bell ringer came from. So, but all of that's kind of relative, like being buried alive, not be in small our reality.
And see, that's perceptions of reality, a lot of different perceptions. So you have that perception where it's really external. I see, I only believe what I see with my eyes,
yes,
my physical eyes.
Yes.
And then there's that more inward thing where I was telling that story about the medicine man up in Canada, Peter Mitten, who looked out the window as they were standing around that kid on the bicycle, and he said, "He's not dead, get away from him." He had a different perception.
He saw the life.
He saw
life
something much
itself.
Deeper than what they were seeing. They were looking at the outward picture. He was looking at something much more inside. And then the story about Jesus and Lazarus. He was looking at something nobody there was looking at.
Right.
Oh, he's been dead for 4 days.
Right.
He's not dead.
Yes. And so in...
So, and that's the idea. In the true reality, there is no death. There is no beginning and ending. It's all right here, right now, all perfection.
Right.
And in the game, there's no way anybody in the game can wrap themselves around that idea. You have to leave it completely.
So we have to look at everything that we see and see it differently.
Yes.
Absolutely everything. And that, so no matter what the circumstances look like, it's probably something entirely different than what it appears.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it definitely is.
So often what looks like a hard time is really like an angel guiding us to a higher awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked about in Revelations that it was the angel, not the beast, that destroyed the error.
Yes, which is signifies truth. Truth destroys error. When you know the truth, it dissolves and destroys the error.
Right.
So that is what is going on. So in Revelation, it looks like the angel has the seven vials of the seven last plagues. But it's just putting it out there so much that... You know, you can't help but I've got to leave this because it's too, it's unbearable. And then it gets destroyed by standing in truth, not by trying to fix the error in thinking.
So we all feel at times that we're struggling alone, but we never really are.
Well, that's part of the game.
Yeah.
We're struggling
alone
because the game says we are for the most part, so look for help within the context of the game.
Right.
And if you go outside of the context of the game, well, you're either crackpot or you're a little bit nutty or you're a sandwich short of a picnic or something. So.
But the truth is when you step out of the small R reality, you find a huge community of people who aren't in it.
Yes, that's true.
It's amazing because we think when we're in the small R reality, well, there's nobody out there to help me if I step out. But in reality, there's a big community that is there.
There is.
It's already there.
It is.
And the thing is, from there, there's even more of a community in the next awareness that we have. So we go through stages of awareness, which is really what the Bible is about. It's not really so much the human story. It's about the states and stages of perception and the changes of awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And each one, that's why they're helpful, because we can find those stories within ourselves that we're changing our awareness of what reality is, which brings us to the New Testament where... Jesus came and said, reality is not at all what you've been perceiving. It's not lack and duality.
Right. And, you know, you don't identify with the struggle and make, well, the struggle, it's what you got to do. You just, like Jesus said, you take your net out of the one side and you throw it on the right side, and then there's all the fish.
Yes.
It's the right side.
So they fished by struggling, and he said... Throw your net on the right side, which is go to the right perception of this.
Yes.
And immediately they had abundance.
Yes.
It didn't take like 10 days for them to collect.
Where the game gives out badges for struggling.
It does.
Badges and awards and merits and everything else. So.
So it would stand to reason that if we're struggling, we're not in big R reality.
Definitely not. You're definitely playing the game. And you're probably feeling good about playing the game or not feeling good about playing the game, but you're still playing the game.
So it does make a difference. That's the question. It does. It makes a difference to choose what perception you choose because it magnifies. You get either lack or abundance. And since we're talking about why are you not choosing the big R reality, which is completely abundance, what keeps you stuck in the small R reality? It's the programming.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been talking about that all along. We get distracted by the programming.
Which is easy to do because it's everywhere. It's all around.
Well, it's a version of hypnosis.
It is hypnosis.
It's a trance.
Absolutely.
And it's many varieties of a trance within the day.
Yes, a program is a trance, yes.
So, today when we were working on this, I went back and I found my notes from college. Which is on this little blue card. So it's a little blue card.
I see that.
I actually wrote this when I was like 18.
Wow.
That was in this smaller reality a long time ago. And I remembered sitting in class going, this is important. And it was a philosophy class. And I wrote it on the little blue card and I still have it today.
It's very neat writing.
And it's very neat. It's not like today. I'm going to read this. I know we've done it before, but it's so important because the teacher was talking about philosophy and he said, did you know there's four ways that you become hypnotized? And the first one is you agree to play by his rules. So under that is the idea consent is contagious. So when we agree to the small R reality rules, we say, oh yeah, that's how it's always been, that's how it always will be, that's how they've always been, that's how always have been. We're already in the first stage of a trance.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first thing. The second thing we do is agree to something we know isn't true. So what's interesting to me about that, and he was talking about, we're used to seeing what are those people called? Somebody that hypnotizes people say you're tired when you know you're not. But really, in the bigger context, it's agree to something, to saying, oh, I think everybody knows that this is a small R reality game. I seriously believe that everybody knows it because there's a part of them that says this can't be what it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll agree to it anyway. And then those people that are so further along that know that there's more, that there's an infinite divine mind, but they still agree that something else is true, that's the second stage. So when you know more, it's like what I was talking about Madison. When you're the wisest one, you have the most responsibility. You can't go back and say, I don't.
Right.
And then the third one, which is we've been talking about recently, is you turn your thought inward.
Yes.
And that is so interesting because when we were talking about covert hypnosis, they talk about that is the biggest piece of it, mm-hmm. is that we turn our thought inward. And that may be confusing because we always talk about you go within, and it's two different things.
Very, very much so, because the context, once again, when you go inward in the context of hypnosis, you're going inside of a tunnel, so you have a pinpoint perception, a pinpoint fueled vision.
It all narrows down.
It all narrows down to a little tiny thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all you see.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a very hypnotic way of saying it.
Mm-hmm.
That's
all
you
see. Yeah.
So it pinpoints that thing.
Mm-hmm.
Where going within, based on listening to the silence, listening within, going deeper and deeper into that calm, reflective place, it expands it.
So you have that wide-angle vision.
It takes you out of the tunnel.
Right. Totally different.
Yes.
So you become more and more aware of what's present, not less and less aware.
And it isn't that because when we do the circular vision, you don't close your eyes. You can do circular vision with your eyes closed,
mm-hmm.
but you open your eyes and do the circular vision.
Right.
And you don't pinpoint something unless you want to identify some little point over here.
But you don't stay there.
You might zero in on and go, oh, that's what that is. You might see a movement or whatever. And then you open it right back up.
Right.
And that creates a whole different pattern of thought.
But one of the things that we get, it's interesting that false truth and truth are so close to each other, and so many people get fooled by false truth. Mm-hmm. So when they think, well, and I hear often people say, I'm going inward, and if they have no relationship that I can say anything to them, that I just went, no, don't do it. Because then they're withdrawing from the people, places, and ideas that actually will pull them out of the situation that they're in. They run, that would be what the small R reality wants you to do, is leave the help of the, don't escape. It's like the old story, the cave, where he crawled out of the cave and saw that there was light, and he went back in the cave to tell all the people who were looking at the shadows, if you come out of the cave, you'll see light. And they couldn't believe him.
Yeah, couldn't comprehend what
he couldn't comprehend it. So you can't go inward. You have to go within. Totally different thing, because inward's hypnosis. And then the last stage of the four points of being hypnotized is agree not to do something you know you can do. Which in the old version was, you can't raise your arm when you know perfectly well you can.
Right.
So when you agree, you agree to what they said. And in the daily life, what that looks like, it looks like being stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And you can feel yourself not wanting to do something when really you know you want to do it, but it feels so heavy. It feels like there's a rope around you, tying you to it. And it started because you've allowed the smaller reality to pull you into that small tunnel, and you have to break out of that.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
So, which is what we're talking about, is how do you break out of it?
Yeah.
How do you get out of the game?
How do you get out of that house?
How do you get out of the house? Yeah.
Yes. There's a story about, the guy's name was Joseph Mann. He was shot by, had a gunshot wound, direct gunshot wound to his chest by a relative, accident. But doctors and people attempted to save him, but they thought it just got to the point where they said, we just can't save him at all. And then he reverted to the science of healing, of the idea from the absolute and the perfection that there is no such thing like that going on in the big R reality.
Right.
He was healed completely of that.
Right.
And he went to Mrs. Eddy and told her about that story. And she said, that's a wonderful story. You got thrown out of the house.
You got thrown out of the small R reality.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you picked yourself out, back up. Now
don't go back in. That's the part I love.
And that's the part that most of us find ourselves doing. We go right back in to that house of consciousness of, you know, it's a game, it's limited, it's finite, it's lacking.
There's lots of agreement back there in that small reality. And sometimes we feel like we don't have agreement on the outside, but we do. But some of the ways that we're talking about, how do you get out of it? And the physicists say this, let me see if I can find it. He says, physicist Dr. Lipton believes that our central voice, or our mind and spirit, actually modifies the behaviors of genes through intent rather than the other way around. So that's just a symbol of that our intent will take us out of the small R reality. If that's your intent,
yes,
and you stay within that intent,
yes,
you will escape.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, you wanted me to read these last two stories so we can talk about what they mean.
Okay.
Okay, so from the same story, the same paper I was reading from before, I'm going to read two other stories. And the story is one of Mary Baker Eddy's students was wanting to learn more about hypnotism, which is what we're talking about, or they called it at the time animal magnetism, which actually is a pretty good word for it. It's the hold into materiality,
mm-hmm.
which is what it is. So he was going away to India to learn about it, and he was standing on the deck of a boat watching the stevedores load the boat. There were great stacks of boxes sitting all over the docks in big orderly piles, and everyone was happily going about his business. Among the passengers, he met a Hindu, and they began to talk. Pretty soon he asked the Hindu, "Do you believe in mesmerism?" Well, it was a beautiful sunshiny day, but all of a sudden the most terrible storm came in from the Atlantic. Great waves smashed into the boat and threw it like a toy against the docks. The wind knocked the big piles of boxes around, knocked some of the stevedores into the water, tore the roofs off some of the buildings, and they had to hold on for dear life to the boat railing to keep from being thrown overboard. It was a frightening experience, and it went on for some time. Then, just as quickly, it stopped, absolutely stopped, and the fellow looked down at the dock, and there were the stevedores going about their business just as quietly as before. All the crates were standing there in perfect order. No roofs were torn off, and the water was as calm as a lake. And the Hindu turned to him and said, "I have just answered your question." The man continued his trip and arrived in India, and he kept his appointment with an adept who was to teach him about this. He was shown to his quarters. They were very sparsely furnished, just a table and a chair, and he was left alone there. Presently the door opened, and a man came in carrying a magnificent big Indian vase. He had never seen anything so beautiful. The man walked in front of him and suddenly lifted that vase over his head and slammed it onto the floor with all his strength. And it broke into 1,000 pieces, this beautiful vase. Well, it was a rather startling experience, but the scientist was a bit prepared because of the experience on the boat. And he remembered what the Hindu had told him. He had said, "The only defense against mesmerism is to hold to a fact. No matter how simple it is, hold to a fact." And he did it right then. And the only fact that came to him at that moment was 2 times 2 are 4, and he held to that. And to his amazement, the vase and all its pieces disappeared from view, absolutely disappeared, and he was alone in the room again. Well, he sat back, rather proud of himself at what he had been able to accomplish, and he allowed his thought to drift away. And when he did, instantly the whole mess was back all over the floor again. He stopped and went back to that fact again. Everything disappeared. He sat there a little while, and pretty soon his thoughts started wandering, and back it all came again. Finally, he saw that he had to maintain that fact, and he did. And with that, the vase disappeared permanently. The door opened, the mesmerist came in, and he said, "You need never fear mesmerism again. You now know the secret of dealing with it. The continuity of it must be maintained, or the illusion will slip back."
Perfect, perfect, perfect. The continuity has to be maintained. Or the illusion slips back. And that's what we're referring to, and we do when we're talking about Women's Council, Shift Masters, the different classes, is you find that place where you have the support to continue to stand in the right viewpoint.
Right.
And then you stay there.
So, and exactly, you keep that, you step into the reality where other people are stepping into the reality rather than trying to make it work in the smaller reality. But we have lots of little skill tools that we've been talking about that people can use to keep that continuity. And one of them that I love when you say accruing the silence. What do you mean by that?
Well, you keep increasing the silence by practicing being silent. You know, there's different techniques that you can do, skills that you can practice. Some of the best ones are that wide circular vision, where you see that whole field of vision at once, because it repatterns your whole thought process. It takes you out of that tunnel vision, and it gives you that idea of silence, because it starts to silence that internal dialogue, that chatter that we constantly hear, that, you know, to keep busy, to do this, to do that, or just myriad thoughts going on. And doing that field of vision, that broad field of vision, opening up that pattern of awareness, starts to silence that. You can also at the same time sit out in nature and just listen for the silence. You hear all the silence. You're still aware of all the all the things that are going on, but you listen for the silence. And what that does is it takes you to the silent place within yourself. You start to hear that silent place within, and again it quiets down that internal dialogue. At that place, now you can start to hear that wisdom. And it comes in subtle ways, and comes in many different ways. And you never know when it's going to just pop up, and there's this great insight that you don't know where it came from.
Right.
And that it works that way all the time. You know, when we talk about education, we've been told we use 10% of our brain.
Right.
And we're even told that Einstein, who was considered a genius, used just a little more than that. Well, now that's interesting because we keep telling everybody, oh, you got to get a better degree, more degrees, you know, go to the higher learning places and the Harvards and the Yales and all this stuff. And we still only have that 10%.
Right.
That should cause somebody to go, what's wrong with this picture?
Yeah.
And then they did studies on Aborigines and Kalahari Bushmen, and they found out these people use 60% of the brain. Now, none of them went to Harvard. None of them went to college. What does that tell you? This is an observation. What is that telling me?
What do they know we don't know?
Yes.
Right.
And there was a researcher who went over to the Kalahari Bushmen, and he had a meeting with them. They were out in the bush, and they were... he was talking to him, asking questions and doing different things. And one of the members, clear out in the bush, just all of a sudden got up, of the bushman, got up and started to walk off. And the researcher's standing there like, where's he going? And he asked that question out loud. Where
is he going?
Where's he going? Mm-hmm. And the other members looked at him and said, what, you don't know? So, no, what? Didn't you hear? He was called. His brother wants him. He said, what are you talking about? I didn't hear anything. He said, yeah, his brother called him. We all heard it. He heard it within.
Right.
See, they were given a different description of the world.
Yeah.
That this is as natural as can be.
Yeah.
You don't have to talk, send emails, phone somebody. It's right there within yourself. You hear it in that silent place. Now, somebody's using 60%, that also means... when you're using 100%, you're probably right there in spirit in that idea.
You are the understanding.
You are. So we can look at somebody like Jesus that we've heard of and did all these amazing things, probably 100%. He was right there.
Right. And it really is that awareness of what truth is.
Yes.
It's that opening up. And when you talk about being in the silence, that when you talk about that, I think in that place, that practice that we do all the time, turning things into thoughts.
Yes.
In a sense, to me, listening to the silence is very much not intellectually turning things into thoughts, but actually having the experience of things turning into the thoughts, the feelings of what God is. Because that's what we're doing. When we're turning things into thoughts, we're returning them to the qualities or the essence of what God is, or infinite mind, whatever one you want to call it, in big R reality. It's turning what looks like a tree, a bird, a house, a car, a piece of grass, your hand, back into the substance of what its true substance in that silence. And you have the essence of it. You might not have the words of it, but you have the essence of it in that place.
Yes, and in that place, it's like when you're practicing the skills and you reach a point, and you can reach this point with intent by having that gratitude of the oneness of what is right there, right at that moment. Because when you have that expanded field of vision and you're in that silence and you see everything, you see the trees and the sky and the clouds and the earth itself and everything as one, the gratitude is right there. You feel that gratitude so deep that I don't know how many times I can tell you that sitting there feeling that, you have that sense of gratitude, it just brings you to tears. It just is so overpoweringly full of joy in that moment.
And you want to bring that sense of gratitude and joy into, you walk into the kitchen to make dinner and you bring that with you. You don't leave it and say it's a separate place.
Yeah, you don't leave it back there by the tree or back there by the stream. That is you. Now, always have that. You have it. Because you walk into the kitchen, there's thought everywhere.
Yeah.
There's thoughts of beauty, of perfection and order and the right
and
supply.
Substance,
it's all right there.
Food and
so the intent
happiness.
Is right there, right now. The intent is that of gratitude and joy and usefulness and order and love and perfection, right here, right now. And then the illusion will attempt to go, no,
it's not enough.
Don't buy the illusion.
It's not enough. It's not perfect.
Yeah. And that's the continuity again of you have to be continuous with what is true.
So holding to the truth, the fact of truth, whatever fact you choose.
Yes, because the continuity of illusion is always there trying to tell you, no, it's not, it's this, it sucks, it's limited.
That's a good point. Continuity of illusion is always present.
Yes, until you stand in the absolute.
Right.
And when you're there, it's like the vase story. The shattered vase disappears. It's not there anymore when you stand absolutely.
And you know what? It isn't so much the vase isn't there, is you're not there.
Yeah.
You're not in the place that a vase shattered. It's hard to get that concept, but it's not like the vase disappears. You disappeared from the place that believes that can happen. And when that happens, your whole world looks like, oh, the outside world shifts, but really what you did is you shifted your perception within, and then of course the outside perception shifts. And then as long as you don't believe the outside perception and its limitation is the reality, you can continue to go that direction.
Yes. And that limited sense of things that, you know, because you hear people all the time saying, oh, no, this stuff's real. Look at this bad stuff that's going on. It's real. And I've met people who are really aware people who still hang on to that as hard as they can.
Because their identity is caught up in it.
They're still caught up in that duality of things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when you can use things like what Jesus talked about when he looked at Peter and said, get behind me, you Satan. And that's the thought of limitation.
Yeah.
Get behind me. You're not part of who I am.
Right. Well, and I know we have a minute, we have time to say this, but one of the things I notice is that people that are moving towards the big R reality and have stopped at a stage where it's actually just a better picture of the smaller reality, and they want to get to the big R reality, but they've got to give up the smaller reality they're holding that looks like it. Some of the things that New Age might practice is close, but not there. And so they might be doing a business within that smaller reality that looks like big R reality.
Mm-hmm.
And that fear of going to the big R reality means they'd have to give up the work that they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is, it will just expand the work into something different.
Exactly.
And better and more of who they are and not less.
Exactly. Because so the fear is part of the game and part of the limited idea of reality. So exactly, if you stand it, when you stand in that idea of perfection in the absolute, it enhances and expands all good things.
Yes.
Because it's all good.
Yes.
So it's not going to make something go away that is the expression of who you are.
Exactly. But that's what it tries to tell you.
It
like
does.
If
and
you
that's
go to big
fear.
R reality, you'll lose your identity, you'll lose your work, no one will love you anymore. I mean, it
comes from the fear that's generated from the context of the game.
Right.
So
but
that's
the absolute,
which is a telltale sign of the observation is, what is this telling you? It's telling you the game's trying to control you still.
Yeah.
And the illusion is trying to keep you in the illusion.
So it's that somersault into the inconceivable,
mm-hmm.
that you have to make that switch into the inconceivable, which is infinity. And did you want to do the quote on the breaking point? Because I see it right there.
Yeah, Don Juan said the breaking point, and this has a lot to do with that continuity. It has a lot to do with what the tools we're talking about, the wide circular vision, the sitting out in nature, the gratitude. It's the breaking point. It's the place where you can accrue that silence. Don Juan said, sorcerers need a breaking point for the workings of inner silence to set in. Sorcerers are not persons. What I mean is that at a given moment, the continuity of their lives has to break in order for inner silence to set in. Now, you hear that word continuity in that context?
Yes.
That's the continuity of the old program and
right.
of the illusion.
Right.
So that continuity has to break and become an active part of their structures. So your breaking point is to discontinue your life as you know it, based on that programming, the illusion, the game.
And so you move into big R reality, which is it, what we talked about. It's kind of like doing a system restore to your game, like restore it, like let step out of the game altogether.
Yeah, like what is this, the psalm? Is it 69? Psalm 69, I restored what I took not away.
Yes.
It was never taken away.
It was never gone.
And yet it's there.
Yes.
But you have to detach from the idea that it's not there and there's some other foolish reality there running the show. You have to detach from that and then you'll see that there it is.
So it's all about choosing the right identification, what reality you live in and who you are.
Yep.
And why not choose the reality, since what you perceive to reality magnifies, why not choose the infinite, divine, good, inconceivable at this moment in time, everything you need reality, why not choose that one?
Yes.
And stay there.
Why not be what you truly are?
Why not? That's a good way to end it. Be what you truly are.
Very good.
Thanks, Del.
Thank you.
Talk to you all later.
All right.
We get to choose what reality we live in. And since we do, let's bring ourselves to the point of view of the best reality we can imagine. In this way, we might touch the edge of bigger reality and experience some of the infinite and its care for all its expressions, unlimited and consistent. You can find this podcast at theshift.com/podcasts. Look for episode 71 or theshift.com/reality2, the number. And if you have a chance, we would appreciate it if you could rate and review on iTunes and share with your friends. Thank you for walking this walk with us as we shift the story together.